My name is Sigrun. I live in Reykjavik, Iceland. I read The Guardian every morning. I realized that this is something that I would like to pay for. It's a service I value. It's journalism I respect. The Guardian brings me the quality I like. So I realized, hey, this is something I should be a part of.
Hello, my name is Brian and I live in Norwich. I decided to become a supporter of The Guardian newspaper because I like the quality of its journalism. And I also felt it was time to make a stand because I'm getting tired of the journalism I'm seeing in other newspapers that are owned by rich owners, where there is a lot of bias into their editorials. I hope this inspires some of you to become supporters too, and in your own small way, make a stand.
Hi, my name is Wesley. I live in Utrecht in the Netherlands, and I recently decided to become a Guardian supporter because it's, well, one of the few news sources that I feel is still delivering accurate news. Yeah, it feels like I can trust The Guardian. For me, that's, I think, the most important thing, and especially when they said we don't want to do too much advertisements and we don't want to become dependent upon other people that can manipulate the news, I felt that it was good to support our democracy.
If, like Sigrun, Wesley and Brian, you would like to join the growing number of readers who support our independent journalism, then go to gu.com/support/podcast.
The Guardian.
And we will make America great again. God bless you and good night.
Brexit means Brexit, and we're going to make a success of it. There will be no attempts to remain inside the EU.
Emmanuel Macron is France's newest president. The 39-year-old centrist defeated Marine Le Pen.
Merci, mes amis.
Welcome to We Need to Talk About Nationalism, the latest of our monthly podcasts in which Guardian journalists tackle a topic suggested by Guardian members. If this is your first listen, welcome aboard. And if you're a Guardian member who has been with us from the beginning, it's really lovely to have you back. I'm Vicky Frost, and this is the fourth in this podcast series and the first which is available for everyone. We initially released these discussions just for members, but we heard from many of you that you thought we should share this debate with as many people as possible, so we were happy to oblige. To chew over the idea of nationalism and why it is currently part of political vocabulary in a way we have perhaps not seen for some time, I'm joined today by Guardian colleagues Randeep Ramesh, Iman Amirani and Ewan McCaskill. Randeep is The Guardian's chief leader writer. If you're not a newspaper reader, then you might know leaders as the non-bylined editorials that set out The Guardian's view on a subject. And Randeep has previously been a foreign correspondent and The Guardian's social affairs editor, among other roles. You may have watched or read Iman's reporting, particularly from France. She is a video journalist at The Guardian, who also writes for our opinion pages. Ahead of Marine Le Pen's defeat in the final round of the French election, Iman argued that even if she doesn't win, her hardline approach to immigrants, multiculturalism and religion has not only influenced the tone of the debate, it has also been selectively adopted by other politicians. More on that later. And to introduce the final member of our panel, Ewan McCaskill, who is The Guardian's defence and intelligence correspondent and also writes about UK politics. Ewan has previously been our Washington DC bureau chief, diplomatic editor and chief political correspondent. Before joining The Guardian, he was the political editor of The Scotsman. So that's our panel, and ahead of today's discussion, I've also been talking to Guardian members who sent in their questions and thoughts on the topic of nationalism. We had a fascinating and fascinatingly varied set of emails from around the world, and I've really enjoyed the discussions I've had with members since. To kick things off, we're going to hear first from a Guardian member in the US, who has one of those deceptively simple inquiries which can prove revealing.
Hi, this is Anne from Pennsylvania in the United States. And my question is, what is nationalism? How does it compare to globalism and imperialism?
So I suggest we start with that question, that idea of what exactly is nationalism, so we can kind of define the parameters of what we're talking about today. Who'd like to start with that? Randy?
Sure. I mean, nationalism, I think, is the ideology that animates a politics which views the political boundaries of any unit as those which are geographically driven. And that means that all those people living within those boundaries live by an agreed set of rules and laws which tend to privilege a certain type of behaviour, although in the past they've tended to privilege a certain type of person. So that's the difference between a a sort of blood and soil type nationalism and a civic nationalism, but it's a national project. We've seen it arrive in Europe in the 19th century. Famously, the man who made Italy, or one of the political philosophers, said, we've made Italy, now we've got to make Italians. So it was a national project. But I think it's not something unfamiliar today, because we've seen it arrive in different forms in Europe, in America, and so it becomes a very pertinent point to ask.
Am I right to think it sort of sits basically opposite to globalism? Is that kind of where we are?
I suppose so. I mean, people have sort of positive that as the case, where they view economic and social liberals who have been embraced by sort of Davos person, and that's the sort of globalist image. But globalisation itself is a project which national states have embarked on. So it's a bit more complicated, but yes, essentially.
Great. Iman, do you have anything to add to that?
Yes, I find it quite interesting because I'm half English and half Algerian, and so I feel like I have quite an international perspective on things. And so for me, when I look at things as being nationalist, I think about it as being something which is about identity and finding like a pure identity, which is something I don't really feel that I fit into. And I feel that that is something which is very separate from globalism. And actually, the question was asking what the difference is to imperialism as well. And I feel like it's, you know, there's more of a link with our history of imperialism and what people claim to be very nationalistic in the UK or in other countries in Europe. I think there's a lot more of a link there. So I see nationalism as being something quite negative, which isn't, it's not in the real description of what it is. It's exactly what Randeep has said. But in practice, I feel that it's something quite divisive.
Like in Algeria, it wasn't a negative force because nationalism helped fuel the case for independence?
Yes, that's definitely true. But then in the end, I think in all countries, you know, any kind of pure nationalism can be something quite negative. And I think that further down the line, whilst it's made a country independent, you can look at things now and you think if there was perhaps a bit more openness to other places in the world, things would be better for people who live in Algeria. In the end, I think it can be actually quite a negative thing.
I think Anne is kind of there on that scale. When I was chatting to Anne, she made an excellent point about the idea of making America great again. And here's what she said. She said, "I love America, but why does loving something have to mean disliking or even hating something else? Because that's what I'm getting from nationalism. And that feels a profound contradiction to everything that makes America great." And I think we can pick up this idea as well with David, who lives in Chippenham in Wiltshire in the UK. And he has a question who touches on those same points. So here's David.
My question is, nationalism might be all very well, and I stress might, but why does it have in practice seemingly to be allied with what is a toxic form of xenophobia?
So I think we should start by asking whether that's the case, because, you know, the Front National is quite a different thing from the Scottish National Party, for instance. Iman, I know you visited Marseille in front of, ahead of the French election. What was the conversation there like?
With regards to nationalism, a lot of people I spoke to in a predominantly right-wing estate, which I went to, they feel that there is a sense of identity being lost, an identity crisis, that they don't know what it means to be French, and that a political system really needs to be representative of the people. And in order to represent the people, you must know what the people are and what brings them together, which I guess in nationalism, that's part of having a unified kind of cultural identity, whether that be behind language or race or religion. But now, as things are getting more complicated in Europe, and especially in France and the UK, and we're seeing many more different minority groups and much more multiculturalism, it's much harder to pinpoint what that is. And people feel very defensive about that, which is why you see people, it's one of the reasons why you see people like Marine Le Pen gaining a lot of followers and a lot of support.
So you think that defensiveness is perhaps what leads to the xenophobic rhetoric?
I think that can be one element of it. It's definitely not the only thing. There are many factors which contribute, especially in places like France and the UK. You know, our histories are quite important. I think we often forget that, and that is removed from the conversation. But I'd be interested to see what...
Again, I'd agree with all that. As Vicky pointed out, in Scotland, it's different. It wasn't different when I was growing up. When I was young, there's a terrible attitude that, you know, Scots almost defined themselves in terms of being anti-English. And they'd laugh it off as a joke and say it was only about sport. But there was always something slightly abhorrent underneath that. But that's gone now for the most part. Scots don't define themselves in terms of being anti-English anymore. And I think that's mainly down to the creation of the Scottish Parliament and a sort of stronger sense of Scottish identity. And also, although Scotland's still predominantly a white society in the way that London isn't, it's still a fairly, people are proud of the multiculturalism that exists there. So I think that's an example of where nationalism isn't necessarily xenophobic.
Randeep, I know you've been interested in exploring the idea of progressive nationalism. So what do you think of this question about whether nationalism has to be allied to sort of xenophobia?
I don't think it does, although I know why Imam says that, and particularly in the Front National, you have that sort of project. But I mean, it's Walter Scott said it best. He sort of said that only a man whose soul was dead would have no feel for his native land. I mean, it's true that where you're from does define you in a certain way. And I think also globalisation does play a part in that, when it's, you know, this world of very rapid change where the middle classes of the West have essentially lost ground in economics, in relative economic status. There's a sort of growing insecurity, and we've seen it with our own politics. So, you know, in the 50s, 98% of us voted for the two major parties, Labour or the Tories. In the last general election, that was down to 75%. And most of those votes have gone to parties who trade in identity politics. Now, some of that is the Green Party, some of that is the Scottish National Party, but they're identity politics. And people seek refuge in a certain identity, a security. And so when you mix those two things together, you can see national movements grow up, and they don't have to be necessarily right-wing. You know, there are left-wing nationalisms. It's a long history that goes back. And the Indian National Congress was a left-wing nationalist party. The African National Congress, Zionism, has a left-wing nationalist pedigree to it. Sinn Féin, famously, left-wing nationalist party.
Catalans, Basques.
The Basques are actually interesting because the PNV is actually a Christian Democrat party, so a right-wing, but actually quite a left-wing agenda, strangely enough. Maybe echoes of politics today. So, I mean, there's always been that. And I think, I suppose, that when nationalisms are struggling against something, they become attractive to people because it's the self-determination of peoples. You know, we instinctively think that's a good thing. When they take power, I think that's when the problems start, because when they take power, the constitutional question has been settled, they've achieved independence, and failure sets in almost immediately. Or, you know, because it's the hope that kills you, you know, because you... And the way to get around that, I suppose, is to say it's a never-ending journey. You know, a history of a nation does not end just because we've achieved it. We're searching for an ever-perfect union. All nations have nationalism. The United States has a nationalism. It is manifest destiny, is the shining example on the hill. You know, there's a whole series of well-established tropes, and every nation has them. So I think the idea that there is necessarily only one shade of nationalism is probably wrong, because all nations have it. It's just in some nations, the political forces that are trading in it happen to be very right-wing, xenophobic, racist ones, and I think that's where we get that attitude.
America's particularly nationalistic. Even people, progressives like Obama, bought into it. This idea that American triumphalism, you can't just say, you know, America's as good as UK or France or Japan. You have to say that America's better than all the other countries in the world. And I was always appalled by that, even by people on the left in America that would buy into this. And again, we see it with Trump too, this idea that he equates nationalism with patriotism and the right wing, as if only right wingers can be patriotic. And again, I'm sort of appalled by that. Whereas, you know, people who are Democrats and the left in America are just as patriotic and just as American. In Scotland, this argument about whether you can be progressive is very specific. People in the Labour Party say that as Randeep said, once people get into power, it changes. The SNP haven't achieved independence, but they've been in power in Scotland and the Scottish Parliament for a decade now. And they argue that their programme is sort of left-wing and progressive. And Labour will argue it's not progressive at all. Things like tuition fees help the middle classes. They haven't done much to improve the lot of the working class and Glasgow or Dundee or parts of Edinburgh. So they're basically a middle-class party rather than progressive. I don't know the details of that well enough to form a judgment.
But I do remember sort of during the last general election before this in the UK when Nicola Sturgeon was in the leaders' debate, and you just got lots of left-of-centre voters in England basically Googling whether they could vote for her because they kind of felt that she was speaking for them in a way other people weren't, which was kind of an interesting moment, I think, for the SNP nationally, as in UK nationally.
Well, maybe, I mean, Labour probably have no chance in this election, but if they were to do well enough, and again, that's not very likely, they would end up in partnership with the SNP. I mean, just before an election, they say no possibility of a progressive alliance, but the SNP will come back with at least 50 seats, so a progressive alliance is a reality.
So I think this might be a good time to hear from Diano Angius, who is an Italian poet who has lived in Cornwall in southwest England for the last 15 years. I had a really fascinating conversation with Diano, who talked me through why he, as an EU citizen living in the UK, would have voted for Brexit, given the chance, and he also supports Cornish independence. So essentially for him, it's about bringing democracy closer to voters and away from unaccountable bureaucracies.
What I think is a good thing of the Brexit, if I could have voted, I would have voted Leave. Not because I want to have more control of my borders, but because I think the European Union is an experiment that at some point is going to collapse because it's not coming from the people, but it's coming from above. There's a strong lack of democracy, and there are like bureaucrats creating rules and laws that are going to affect the life of people that actually they didn't want. I moved to UK in 97 when I started to feel that this unification of Europe was nothing but some sort of operation of banks and powerful people, and that would create a sort of standardization of European people and killing the local sense of national identities.
So do you believe in Cornish independence?
Well, yes, I do. I believe in a federation of states that are all connected in some way.
More devolution.
Devolution, yes, exactly. Less power to few politicians and more power to more people. That's what I think is going to happen in the future.
So I wonder if we're presuming that things are about feelings of nationalism, about the idea of taking back control of borders, when actually they're possibly about taking back control of politics. What do we think about that? Or is this Diano, is he in a minority here?
I mean, personally, when I hear that kind of argument, I can't agree with it at all. I think obviously we need to have more control over our local politics, but things like Brexit, for me, I see that as removing a kind of safeguard that exists around, which protects people who in specific places might be in minorities, or, you know, who will be, you know, they don't have the same level of representation, even if we do bring things to a local level. I think that that's actually quite a dangerous thing, and especially when it comes to this question of nationalism and what that means. You know, if we start thinking too much like that and closing things off into our own spaces, I think it's quite divisive and dangerous. But that's just how I see it personally.
There is no such thing as British sovereignty. I mean, there's a whole complex, whole series of layers. The average person in the UK has a council. If you're in Scotland, you have a council, and you've got the Scottish Parliament, you've got the British Parliament. And the European Parliament and the European Union was just another layer. And it was a convenient one. It was, on the whole, helpful, and we've just decided to eliminate it.
I think he's got a point in that. Leave aside Brexit, because I think it's a slightly different issue. We can come back to it. But I think the idea of saying to people, look, there is a better way of organising our lives, and that means choosing a different kind of political system, a different setup, in which, you know, we could work together in a different way. That's partly about norms, about the way culturally we get on, and that's different to other people. And that's partly because the unfair structures of democracy that have been imposed upon us. And I use that imposed word because I think that partly explains this and the sort of Brexit kind of thing, which is, if you view it as a sort of Europe as some kind of nefarious imperial project imposing stuff on you, then you get to the point where you sort of say the only way of doing this is to create something new. And the Scottish sort of nationalist kind of conversation has that element to it as well. It's a very powerful thing to tell people, actually, there's this distant empire running your lives, this supernatural kind of project. You don't know much too much about it. And the best way thing to do is to work out something new among ourselves, because we're people apart. And then we can see what we can do with those guys. And I think that's quite a strong pull on people's lives, especially when they get atomized and kind of, you know, kind of economic forces kind of throw them all around a bit. And see, I think people can get themselves into that space. The only thing I'd say about Brexit, as unfortunately, is I think it has fanned the flames of a sort of nationalism that I don't really like. But I mean, I think that's where you can kind of get to if you carry on that language. And there are some people who did throw off an imperial yoke, and it did make that, you know, it did change them. Freedom is, you know, a highly prized commodity. I just don't think Britain was in the same, was in that place with the European Union. Although Cornwall, I know that sentiment does exist vis-a-vis London, so I can understand that, and I can understand Scottish resentment about, in Scotland, not least because in 1707 they lost a parliament. It took them until 1998 to get one back. So, I mean, I think that's a sort of fairly easy hit for them.
You're right that in Scotland, the SNP portray Westminster as remote. But there's more specific things than that. They'll now argue you're looking at a Conservative government for the next 5 years. So they're saying that Westminster doesn't represent the views of people in Scotland. And in another twist than that, if they do have the referendum, and I'm pretty sure they will, it's just a matter of timing, on independence, their argument will be, you know, vote for the SNP, vote for independence, and you've got a chance of rejoining Europe, at least as part of the European single market.
Talking about that European aspect to it, I talked to Maya, who's a Guardian member living in Germany, who gave this interesting perspective about nationalism not being such an issue in Germany. But she says there's still a gap between a sometimes better educated, more internationally mobile younger generation and a left behind generation, which I think we've heard quite a lot about. And she was asking how we could bridge the gap between old and young, and in doing so, stop history repeating.
After reunification, this place, Eastern Germany, has changed a lot, especially my generation. People have gone to university at a rate that was just completely unknown to people until then. And I noticed more and more that my friends, they don't get along with their families. Their parents, their grandparents, they all stayed in very small towns. People who didn't go to university and who didn't get access to that type of education. And I can see how alienated people are from each other. And I can kind of understand that a lot of anger is born out of that. I think digitalization and education has created a new culture. And this culture cannot be grasped with stuff like patriotism and nationalism, because it has nothing to do with it. And a lot of people don't understand and feel lost. And that's kind of my impression, at least for a part of the people who are turning to nationalism right now.
So that idea of the left behind, the people who haven't benefited from globalization, you think that's what is perhaps fueling?
Yes, I think it's not an excuse. I mean, I think xenophobia and racism are obviously wrong. I'm a person of color, so I don't think it's fun. And I get to experience it from time to time as well. But I do think that the political elite has kind of ignored a group of people, and they are trying to get themselves heard right now in a way that has surprised many people. It has surprised me because I had noticed them before all this started to happen.
I know you were saying that for Germany, you know, nationalism is a very complicated thing.
Germany hasn't had a stable border for many hundred years, actually, and people have been leaving their hometowns and going to new places and having to live there after Second World War and First World War and after reunification. My generation has been going to Western Germany because there's better pay there, there's better universities there, etc. So I think Germany would need a completely different solution for feeling of belonging, but it doesn't seem like anyone is looking for it. So a lot of people have just renounced that question, and rather they tell themselves, well, I'm from Berlin, so that's my home and stuff like that. They don't talk about, well, I'm German. I think the European Union has been an answer for many young people. They prefer to say, well, I'm European, and that fits them way better.
There does seem to be not just a generation, but sort of a whole swathe of people who do understand themselves as European. But it does leave that question of the people who don't see themselves as that, how do they see themselves and how do they manage to vocalise that, I guess?
Yeah, especially for older people from Eastern Germany, because they used to belong to another country and that country disappeared 30 years ago. And I suppose they were hoping to get a new answer for their belonging after reunification, but they have been completely forgotten. And the European Union has not replaced it for them because they haven't profited from it at all. The concept of nation is something that has been around for a long time, but I don't think this concept has a solution for these people who are left behind by digitalization, globalization, etc.
Now, Iman, as the youngest person around the table today, I'm going to do that really frustrating thing of saying, yes, what do all young people think? Sorry about that. But I do want to come to you because I did wonder if you have views on particularly how the Brexit vote has split younger and older voters. As a reminder, younger people, I think, voted about 70% to remain with a turnout of 64%. So that's kind of quite high numbers. And I was struck recently by Frans Timmermans, who's the Vice President of the EU Commission. He was describing young people as instinctively European, which is something I thought I recognised. So I wonder what you think about that.
Whenever I think about that divide between the generations, I remember my friend Vooj tweeted the day of the result. He said, "That's it. I'm never giving up my bus seat for an elderly person ever again." And I felt so strongly that I completely agreed with him. And I think there is a massive divide. I think that a lot of people assume that younger people don't understand why it's happened, why you might be Eurosceptic. I really do understand why people are Eurosceptic. I get that. It's not just I want to go on holiday to Spain and, you know, be able to get a good exchange rate for my euros. I understand all of that. I just feel that younger people were scared that their doors were closing off. And, you know, we've only just had university fees raised to £9,000. And we haven't had even 2 years to start exploring, you know, the possibilities of studying abroad where we can get bursaries and actually have so many different options that they're being closed off by our government here in the UK, and they're still being left open in Europe. So things like that are real reasons why younger people feel quite strongly about this, and older generations, they don't have to worry about that. I think that it gets very frustrating when you feel that the decision has been made by a generation of people who, they got free education, they own houses, they have jobs and job security, and they've kind of decided for our futures that things will be a lot more restricted. So I think there is a massive divide.
I have a cousin who's 17, so she couldn't vote in the referendum, and now she won't be able to vote in the general election either, who is just furious, you know, at this kind of, this is a country that's going to be handed to her, and she just won't be able to have, and she won't be able to make a difference on that, but she will be growing up in it. And I get it. I kind of feel like, yeah, I would be really cross too.
I mean, one of the best things I can say about my generation is that we're dying off. If you look at the statistics, it's not just in Brexit, but in for the Scottish independence. If you look at the figures for people 16 to 25 who support independence, it's huge. And it's almost the opposite when you look at people over 65. So, you know, the case for independence, you know, if they hold it again in 2 or 3, 4 years' time, I think it's more likely to go through, partly for that generational reason. And if there's a chance of another vote on Brexit down the line, which seems less likely, we'd probably get a different outcome as well.
So it might be useful to hear a bit more from David, who we heard a question from earlier, because he is a mature student. He's 65. He's doing a PhD, and he has huge concerns about the fallout from Brexit. And he probably sort of blurs that generational divide a little bit for us.
I'm a very mature, if you like, postgraduate research student at the University of Bristol in musicology. And of course, in that environment, I work with a lot of staff who are from the EU and also with other postgraduate researchers. And we are all very worried about the implications of a rise of rather blinkered nationalism in this country and what that might mean just on a personal level to our PhDs, how we might complete them, what we might do afterwards. And also on a broader level of intellectual and cultural cooperation, and also a sense in which those of us who are British by birth, like I am, feel rather ashamed of the sort of nationalist rhetoric that's going around and hostility towards the EU and by extension towards people from the EU. I don't see why we can't be more generous as a population. That's what we used to pride ourselves on being, and it seems to be being lost. We're always better if we're collaborating and cooperating as a species. That's what the human species does. But I suppose I'm very close to potential effects at the moment because of being in the university. And of course, I'd be the first to acknowledge that universities are a bit of a bubble. But it's a bubble that spreads beyond the borders of one country and reaches into another. Several others.
So David said he was deeply anxious that the tenor of the debate around Brexit and nationalism will cut the UK off from our shared intellectual endeavours and our shared culture. I mean, I wonder if you share those concerns or whether you think the UK will actually stay connected to Europe post-Brexit regardless.
I think it's inevitable that it will do. I mean, I think Brexit, if the best that can come out of it is really that we reforge those bonds that we have, because we share basically too much to go anywhere, apart from the fact geography is destiny and we're stuck there. And I really feel for Imam's generation and partly mine. I got children, you know, why would I want them to have narrower horizons than I did? It doesn't make sense to me. There can be all sorts of arguments for Brexit. I understand good arguments for Brexit. You know, maybe I don't agree with all of them, but I can see why they were made. But I just think at the end of the day, if a sort of proportion of your kind of population is kind of split in two and it's demographic, that just doesn't feel kind of as if you've cohered around a national identity of any kind. It's a kind of very divisive way of progressing, is you split the country in two and you sort of say one side's patriotic and the other side is, well, God knows what they are. And that for me is the real problem bit of it, is that the vote basically starts cleaving people and allows the sort of blood and soil nationalism of, like, are you a traitor to where that, you know, a traitor to the way that we are proceeding. And I think that's the bit that I find really difficult to sort of come to terms with.
We're going to hear from Richard Ross now. He's a member in Edinburgh, and he's also been in touch with an eye to Brexit. Richard joined the SNP the day after the referendum. That was his prompt to join the SNP. So Richard and I had an interesting discussion about squaring the circle of wanting Scottish independence, but also remaining part of the EU, and those conflicting desires at times. So let's hear from him now.
Obviously, there are people who are in favour of independence, but they're not in favour of the European Union. But I would say that's probably a very small minority. I think people that are in favour of independence see Scotland's place in Europe in the same way as they see the place of other North European countries like Denmark or Sweden or Finland with comparable populations.
A really great line in your email to us said, "It's a shame that nationalism is on the rise, but in my opinion, it's never been away. And it's just, in Britain, this has been mediated largely through an English view of the world."
Yeah.
So that's an interesting idea, that actually it's always been there, you think?
Yes, I mean, I think one of the problems in Brussels, for example, in the relationship between British people and their attitudes in Brussels is that, this sounds terribly critical in a way, but I think that there is a section of English society, probably public school educated, gone to Eton, Cambridge and so on, who are used to being the rulers in the empire. And they don't take kindly to the fact that they have now to behave as equals in the European Union. They're just one voice. They're not a dominating voice.
So you think Brexit, well, for some people, it may have been about reasserting Britain as a great power, basically.
That's right. And I think this is a terribly destructive road to go down. You know, that period in our collective history is gone, and we have to face that.
And Richard had a question that leads on from this.
How is British nationalism / identity different from English nationalism / identity? I suspect that for many, perhaps most people in England, they are one and the same thing. My feeling is that increasingly people in Scotland do not accept that view, and that they believe there is here a distinctive, more inclusive voice which requires to be heard in, for example, the European Union?
That's an interesting question, isn't it? What do you think, Iman?
I find it interesting when we put it in those terms, because I really would never describe myself as English. My mum's from the north, she's from Stockport, and I guess my mum's side of the family are very, very English. They're UKIP supporters, many of them actually. But I don't like the word English because I feel like it's been hijacked and claimed by people who don't think that I represent what it is to be English. Being British, well, you've got the BNP, that's the first thing that comes to my head, which is quite sad. I do consider myself to be European, even though when I go to places like France, I think British people, we've got such a better sense of humour. I think, you know, and I consider myself to be British when I'm there. So it is very complicated and there are all these layers to it.
I've never described myself as British. It's on my passport, but I would never say that. I'd say I'm Scottish or European.
But I think there's something to be proud of in being Scottish and claiming that.
I think the English always had a problem with nationalism. I mean, partly because they're one of the oldest nation states, and they've worked out it's not a very good thing to go around telling people. I mean, because of all the bad stuff they've done. And George Orwell used to have this line, which is more pertinent now than ever before, which he said, the English would rather steal from the poor box than stand for the national anthem. The English middle class is a particularly unpatriotic lot who'd take their cookery from Paris and their politics from Moscow. I struggle with calling myself English, and I prefer British, but that's partly because the English wrote a lot of history the way they wanted it to be written, and it's always difficult to stomach when, you know, you kind of think, hang on a minute, it wasn't quite like that, was it? But I think that English nationalism is going to come back. I think it's inevitable, because I think Scottish nationalism is there. The Irish question is opened up in Brexit, with Brexit. I cannot see England not having a politics around identity. I mean, it just seems to me that it will arrive. It's only a matter of time. And left-wing parties will have to deal with it as well as right-wing. I mean, right-wing parties have always traded on these things, so it's a kind of unfortunate but inevitable event.
There is a Scottish conceit that the nasty sides of British history, you know, slavery and things like that, were somehow the responsibility of the English.
English, yeah.
Whereas it was just as well. I mean, slavery is identified with Liverpool and Bristol, but it was just as much Glasgow.
Yeah.
In terms of the empire,
the Scots and the Irish did their bit.
They did their bit.
No, I mean, I think it's interesting, actually. Scottish nationalism and the compact I think it had with the English sort of upper classes was basically, we're allowed to have our own institutions. You give us access to markets via the imperial trading system that you set up, and we'll, you know, we'll have all these big heavy industries. And I think as every one of those things went, and then power was centralised in Westminster, it's an inevitable Scottish reaction to that, which just sort of says, well, hang on, you left us with nothing. You know, what do we get out of this union? Well, it's diddly squat, and that's why you get these explosions.
So I'm going to bring us to our final questions now, which are focused around the idea of why we think nationalism has become a bigger part of conversations around the world at this moment. Kathy in Edinburgh wrote to us, and she put it simply, asking, in an uncertain and changing world, does nationalism offer a sense of security and belonging not available elsewhere? And Janice in Canada asked us to consider whether nationalism is an inevitable consequence of economic uncertainty. So I think I'm interested in how much does economic instability play a part here, and whether that's more true for some parts of society than it is for others. It feels like there are some bits of society more hit by globalisation, for instance, than other parts of it. What do you think, Randy?
Well, I think the Brexit vote showed that a bit, because it was the least educated voters, if I can put it like that, who voted heavily for Brexit, and they're the ones with the least tradable skills, if you like it, and, you know, they weren't the ones dashing off to France to organise some hip-hop gig.
So are you two on weekends?
No, but, you know, if I had
feel
those
like
skills...
that was an indirect towards me, you know?
Oh, no way! No, it wasn't like that at all. What I'm saying is they couldn't take advantage of the wider market that was presented by Europe. There was a bit of kind of like, no one has listened to us for such a long time in politics, and here is a chance for you to hear our voice. And they voted, and they might have voted against their economic interests, but I think that voice thing was quite quite potent for them, you know.
It makes me think about the fact that what with us not having as much of a strong kind of faith and such a strong identity associated with things like religion, it feels like everywhere people are grasping for something which will give you some sense of structure. Or same can be said for people who live in London and are deciding to become vegans, or there's lots of trends that are happening. And I think that the first part of that question was about things being very uncertain and unstable. And I think that all over the place, it's not just people who are becoming nationalistic. There's this idea that things are so unstable and we need to have some kind of structure. But without things like religion, how do you do that? And how do you kind of create lines within which you can live your life? And nationalism's just one of those ways.
Yes, and I was sort of struck that some of the people who are most hit by the economic instability are younger people, who everything that went before is now not available, and yet their reaction was not to vote, particularly for Brexit. So it holds and it doesn't, I think, that argument. I don't know what you think, Ewan.
Yeah, it's an interesting paradox. My feeling on Brexit was that the older people, it was as much about nostalgia as anything else. Older people in some of the southern counties, that's sort of nostalgia for a Britain that never existed. And among, you know, what Randeep was talking about, the dispossessed, it was just an anger at a system that's let them down, and you channel it into anti-establishment vote.
If you look across Europe, there are parties who have traded on that, whether it's the Danish People's Party, the Swedish right-wing parties, the Front National. I mean, they're all playing of that same textbook, which is, I think, entirely different to the Scottish nationalist, I mean, to a certain extent, Sinn Féin, you know, the kind of left-wing versions of that, whether that's the PNV, the Catalunya Party, the Quebecois kind of movements, which have a kind of left-wing progressive agenda, even if they are separatists. They're trying to motivate people on a different basis. But this thing that has emerged with Brexit and the kind of right-wing, xenophobic, blood and soil kind of nationalism is a different beast. You're right, I talk about nostalgia, looking back to the past for the future. That's really quite a bad place to take your politics from, I think, because the past doesn't really exist, it's a myth.
So that's where we're going to end, which is a slightly glum note, sorry. But I am going to have to bring us to a close there. So I'd like to thank the panel, Randeep Ramesh, Emmanuel Moroni and Ewan McCaskill. Thank you all.
Thank you very much.
And of course, all the Guardian members who provided our questions and shared their thoughts. If you'd like to contribute to the next podcast, keep your eye out for a call out in the next couple of weeks. And if you'd like to email us with your thoughts on what we should tackle, you can do that by sending an email to weneedtotalkabout, that's all one word, @theguardian.com. I've been Vicky Frost, and We Need to Talk About Nationalism was produced by Stuart Silver and Rowan Slaney. Until next month, goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.